Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We are Baltimore Positive. I am resplendent in my foreign daughter and curio orange gear, and I say it proper. Baseball season's here. Pitchers and catchers, Sarasota. I might get my press credential. I don't know. Stop asking me. Don't ask me. Ask them. I've asked nicely, I think. Either way, I'm about to do a baseball segment that has. I feel like I just gave birth with this segment because this guy's been coming on for like years. He called me a couple years ago. He said, "My name's John Miller." I'm like, "You're a hell of a bra." Oh, different John Miller. This is the John Miller from the Wall Street Journal, longtime reporter, real journalist, who has put together finally the baby, as well as in his real life, where he is a parent of a newborn, two babies in 1 month. The last manager is now here. It's real. All of the incredible pre-press you've gotten, John, as well as all the research you did on programs like Baltimore Positive here over the last couple of years. But George Will, Ken Burns, just a who's who of baseball lovers and Earl Weaver lovers. And John, first off, congratulations, not just on the birth of your child, but also the birth of the book and getting it all out. But I've been with you the whole time, man. I've been on this journey with you ever since my wife started laughing at the incredible video of the Mike Flanagan, Eddie
Oh, Howard.
Murray. How are you? And how's your baby life and making book life? And I know you're going to be here in Baltimore on a very, very special day in my life. So.
You know what brings us all together is a shared passion for baseball and the Orioles. And I love the Orioles, although I'm also a high school varsity baseball coach, Alderdice High School in Pittsburgh. And I'm wearing the hat right now. I'm going to go to batting practice in an hour. It's the alma mater of Larry Lucchino, who people in Baltimore remember. That's where he went to high school.
Oh,
And
future
so,
Oriole Hall of Famer Larry Lucchino should have been in the Hall of Fame the whole time. I'm gonna give you
And so
that.
this book is like kind of a combination to talk about babies. It's kind of a baby between my journalism career and my baseball career. I played college baseball at Mount St. Mary's in Maryland, and then worked as a scout for the Orioles a little bit. Did a lot of baseball stuff in my 20s and 30s, and so along with having a career at the Wall Street Journal as a reporter, so this project is kind of the marrying the two. I mean, I wrote Earl's obituary, as you know, for the Wall Street Journal. It's kind of got this project rolling. And I have spent the last 3 or 4 years, and you and I met because you did one of the last interviews with Earl, which is one of the best interviews with Earl, where he was sincere and a lot more open than he was in previous media appearances. So that's how we got together. And I appreciate it, Nestor. And you contributed to the book, obviously. I think it's the definitive biography of Earl Weaver, which is a story for all of baseball. And I'm excited for all of baseball to share the story with us.
Well, you've been on a handful of times from the beginning, and you did find me sort of honest. And I got an email from some guy named John Miller said I'm writing a book on Earl Weaver. And I mean, you flowered me all up, dude. You dapped me up good with how good that interview was. And I think I've told the story about that because I do want people to go back and watch it if they haven't, because it's kind of cool. But Earl Weaver's agent was Luis is still alive. Luis is the oldest living Hall of Famer, as pointed out by Bob Ryan on the internet the day Willie Mays died. But Luis' agent was a man named Dick Gordon, who was a Baltimore Pikesville native and was an agent for Carl Yastrzemski and Louie Tiant, a whole bunch of ball players of that era. I mean, every Jim Palmer would know him and had worked with him. A lot of card shows and autograph shows, just all of that sort of booking in Louis's, post career, his Hall of Fame career. And Earl Weaver was doing the statues. It was the statue summer. And I lived at Harbor Court. And Dick said, "You want Earl?" And at the time, I was working on a book that I never did on Baltimore leadership and on people who had led in Baltimore. And I've talked about this three or four times a year. Somebody comes on that was a part of that and they asked me if I'm ever going to put it back together. Earl Weaver would be a part of it. I turned down interviews with Don Shula, who has now died, Schnellenberg. I'm just an idiot. I'm an absolute idiot. But I did sit with Earl that day. And I don't know why you believe that, but speak to that a little bit because it's a nice little entryway because I really do believe it was the last time he was ever interviewed. I don't think anyone ever spoke to him again and certainly didn't sit with him and talk about weird stuff because it seeded your relationship with me that half an hour. He said, "I'll give you 10 minutes, kid." 30 minutes later, he's sitting there talking about Elmira and the St. Louis Browns. It was awesome,
Well,
you know?
he spoke from the heart. What I loved about it was he spoke from the heart, and he revealed a lot more of the non-Orioles story of his life. I mean, he spent 20 years in the minors before he got to Baltimore. He had a brief, glorious career as a prospect. He was a much better player than people remember. And he was kind of screwed out of a job in spring training by Eddie Stanky, who's one of the famous jerks in baseball history. And he kind of carried those wounds his whole life. He always wished he could have been a player. He didn't really like managing. He found it very stressful, but that was his destiny. He was so good at it. And in Elmira, you bring up Elmira, I mean, that's where he learned how to be a winner. And so where he also developed the psychology he had. He sold cars in Elmira, and he was very good at reading people. And so he loved pop psychology books like the Dale Carnegie books, and he believed in hypnosis. He liked to think he could hypnotize people. And so he had a real curiosity about human beings that helped him become a great manager. And you brought a lot of that out of him in that interview, and the vulnerability too. This is not somebody who was 100% sure of himself. He was always seeking approval from Major League Baseball players. He was wanting to be part of the club. As a short little guy who was not always welcome among jocks, he wanted to be one of the ball players. And so he carried that suffering of having to reject players, of having to break their hearts when the time came for him to be a manager, just like his heart had been broken by Eddie Stanky with the Cardinals.
John, it's fascinating, man. I mean, I haven't had you on in maybe about a year. It's been a little while, and you kind of went to print with it, and it's now out. The book is The Last
I'm glad you got a
Manager, and
heart.
well, I
You got a
appreciate you
hardback
sending it.
copy. It's
Yeah,
amazing.
I appreciate it. I have it. It's old. I like to touch things. I can't. I'm not
Look how pretty
Kindling.
that is. Isn't that a
Yeah,
beautiful
look,
book?
it's got a whole spine on it, like the whole
Oh,
deal,
so
you
I
know.
know that.
Dude, I've written a
Such a nice
couple
job they
books,
did.
and I know what it's like when the box comes and you open it, and then
Yeah.
your arm hurts from autographing it because you're not used to signing stuff, and you think,
Yeah,
"Oh, I get to
yeah.
sign books; it'll be really cool." And then you want to write stuff to people, and then you're just like, "Oh, just get me," you know, when you're sending them out. And this, you're new to like this, all fresh. You're coming to Baltimore on March 5th. I want people to come out and all that, but I want you, like
Pratt Library.
you came into me with that video that I did with Earl. And the amazing thing of that day is I had my wife held the camera that day. It was in the lobby. It was
Yeah.
a lot of ambient noise. And he was so little. I mean, he died 6 months thereafter, maybe 5 months later,
Yeah.
he passed away. And my wife was expecting this cantankerous guy. And I think we had encountered him maybe a decade before, half a decade before, my wife and I at an event maybe that was like a 66 reunion. It was a 70 reunion. It was Bernie Carbo. It was Bernie Carbo. It was a 70 reunion. So I guess it was in maybe 05 or 10 or wherever it was. And Earl could be cantankerous. But when we
Yeah.
encountered him that day, he said, "I'll give you 10 minutes," and gave me a half an hour. And then when we left, my wife left saying, "He was sweet." You know, and
Yeah.
I guess there was another side of Earl that even John Eisenberg, who's been on recently, talks about Earl taking him out on a golf cart saying, "How much are you paying me for this?" And you know, they'd known each other forever and all of that. But you took
Yeah.
this topic on in a whole different way than funny Earl or little Earl or cute Earl.
Well,
You sort of went psychology Earl, and that's why you're getting so much praise on this book, because it's not
it's
as much a baseball book as it is an Earl in baseball book, right?
about a human being who is complicated. But now you're making me glad that I didn't have to deal with him. I think he was a handful. But he was also a complicated guy who could be very generous. I mean, there was a ball player that older Orioles fans will remember named Bobby Bonner. And he was kind of a rival for Cal Ripken for that shortstop third base position in the 81-82. And Earl kind of stepped on him and kind of ran him out of town. And then years later, apologized to him and gave him a big hug and said he felt terrible for that. But he was somebody who could speak to anybody. George Weigel, who's the biographer of Pope John Paul II, said that listening to Earl talk baseball was like listening to Homer recite the Iliad. So he had a depth to him that appealed to all these intellectuals, including writers like Tom Boswell and Roger Angel, who I grew up reading, and are kind of like the source, the inspiration for the book is really these guys falling in love with Earl and me reading about it. And I grew up, my mom's from Catonsville, but I grew up in Belgium, by the way, and so I grew up with baseball in America being far away, but reading about Earl Weaver and being fascinated by him, and not just as a winner, because I was an Orioles fan, and this is like the late '80s when they were terrible. As a winner who represented this glory time in Orioles history, but also as a really interesting, complicated person. So I think that's what you're getting at. And yeah, I feel like, I mean, there's a chapter about his alcoholism There's a chapter about his relationship with hypnosis, psychology, along with all the great Orioles stories and all the umpire stories. That's all in there. So I think it's a comprehensive look at Earl Weaver's life.
Let us have a reading from page 187. This is the Reggie. I met Reggie in 86 with Ted Patterson at Memorial Stadium. Reggie Jackson, to this day, I think of some athletes that I didn't think much of. Terrell Suggs was up for the Hall of Fame. I don't think much of Terrell Suggs. But people you were around once in your life who you idolized and were so awful to you, Reggie was that guy. Now, Earl wasn't that guy. Now, Earl, I was around Earl a lot, 80s, 90s, drunk Earl at the Thompson Sports Banquet and Palmer and he fighting, like all of those kinds of things. Earl was ubiquitous around here. And I did have a press pass in 86, 87, 88 when Earl was kind of trying to come back and do his thing that time or whatever. I was never afraid of Earl. He was kind of short, and you sort of knew the sound of his voice, like you would know the President of the United States' voice if you're from Baltimore, right? And you're a kid who loved baseball. But I didn't find him to be intimidating as much as I found him to be respected in some way, even though he was this tall, because he was baseball, right? Like he was a guy every Boswell, every baseball person wanted to hear him talk baseball. And a lifetime later, and a death later, and now one book by John Miller later, you're trying to bring out the wisdom in a way that the godfather of analytics and all that's changed the game, Earl was a guy on the way, way, way front end of that. And I think you're pointing that out. And I think that's why the scholars are after him in the book, you know?
That's all true, but his story is also the story of a changing America. And I think the gambling chapter represents that the best. Like, he grew up in pre-white flight St. Louis, 1930s, 1940s, a world of crowded taverns and bookies. His uncle was a bookie. So Earl learned analytics from gambling, which was like on the street, a time when Americans lived closer to each other, when they would walk to the ballpark. Obviously, after the war, the suburbs were built and people, gambling was cracked down on. Now gambling's back, it's legal. It's all the same stuff, but we're just living in a different way. And Earl's career is really a trajectory from the old world of baseball and cities and walking to the park to the suburbs, to TV, to online, to gambling. He's the one. He's the bridge character. He's the only manager who was the manager 5 years before and 5 years after free agency came in '76, where, as you said, Reggie was the big prize. Spent his free agent year with the Orioles. The Orioles couldn't offer him enough money, so he went to the Yankees, won a couple World Series. But Earl loved Reggie, and Reggie loved Earl because Earl didn't play favorites. He wanted guys who could play well, rewarded good play. He didn't hold grudges.
He
Anyway,
also
so yeah, I
wasn't a
think there's a bigger
racist,
story.
right? Like in the way
He's
that
not,
he
yeah.
grew up in the racism of the game
I mean,
where.
that's, yeah, I love that part of it. Yeah, he, as a young man, used the N-word, was part of that culture, but then really matured and by his own admission grew. And I think there's a beautiful story there of how we're all capable of growth, how nobody needs to be excluded from being able to learn from their own mistakes, from being able to grow. And Eddie Murray loved him. Frank Robinson, he helped Frank become the first black manager in baseball history by promoting him. And there's a 50th anniversary of that this April 8th, by the way. Frank in that game for the Cleveland Indians, not only did he manage, he hit a home run. And you know who also hit a home run for Cleveland in that game was Boog Powell. And Earl, after the game, he was in a different city, but he said, "I'm happy for Boog and Frank and those home runs, but them would have been fly balls at Memorial Stadium."
I
So
saw
he
this
couldn't
great
help but
picture of I'm sorry, with Frank.
get a
We're a
dig
little bit of a
in.
delay. A great picture of Frank Robinson and John Lowenstein in the on the old Indians uniforms. And I thought that's kind of cool because you think of Baltimore with those guys, you know.
Well, Boog Powell's on that team too. They traded Boog. I have a piece in the Washington Post coming up in the next few weeks about that, about Frank and Earl and race. Ken Dixon, who you probably remember from the 80s, loves Earl. We become friends. We talk a lot. He said Earl. He said, he called him in his office. He said, you can be a great pitcher. Just you got to do your effing job. And he said other coaches would like kind of look at him, call him boy, like be conspicuously racist towards Ken, who's black. And Earl wasn't like that. Earl could be hard on you, but he treated you like a man. And so there was a humanity there again that was authentic and in a way beautiful. I mean, I think Earl Weaver, I say you would not have wanted him to date your daughter as a young man. And he was rough around the edges and he had a drinking problem. He's a chain smoker. All this stuff is true. But it was also true that he had a heart and that he was complicated and that he looked at you and looked at himself honestly. And that's one thing that Tom Boswell writes too, that he, Earl Weaver, looked at the world and was always open to transformation in a way that was really rare, not just for baseball managers, but pick any category of human, a politician, teacher, journalist. We're all afraid of evolving, but Earl Weaver showed us how we could.
John Miller, the other John Miller, the author from formerly the Wall Street Journal, has authored a book called The Last Manager. He will be at Enoch Pratt Library on my father's birthday. I guess it would be my dad would have been 106, born in
Happy birthday. Oh, wow.
1919. Yeah, so March 5th, very, very special day in my life. The first 20 years that I did radio here, it was a day of phone calls to honor all fathers. It was our Father's Day here before at the beginning of NST 28 years ago. I don't want to say I've given it up on behalf of my dad, but I every day is an homage to my dad around here. And my dad, I would say that I grew up in Dundalk in the 70s, and I would say Archie Bunker's Dundalk, right? My middle school, I didn't elementary school, middle school, never had an African American other than a teacher who I've honored and still alive as our music teacher. Turner Station, historically African American community here. I always tell the story in high school. The 15% of the kids that were black in our school all sat at the three tables in the corner in the 80s. It's just the way it was. And I think of Archie Bunker's America. And I think there may be some equating Earl Weaver to having this Archie Bunker sort of personality, sort of look like each other at the same time on TV or whatever. But you're saying that Earl was a different, evolved kind of cat. And I never really thought about Earl and racism. And I've talked to Ken Singleton a million times and different people like that. I've never heard an ill word about Earl in that way, probably because it didn't exist.
Kenny loved him, and by that time he had evolved, and he understood that. I mean, also, as a time when 18% of major league players were African American, and now it's like 6%. So, if you didn't get along with black players, you're not going to be a good manager. And so, I say in the book, Earl Weaver is not so interested in racial justice, but he was interested in winning, and he was interested in being authentic, and he wasn't a liar. And that's one thing that is, again, a great credit to him. Yeah, I mean, it's an important topic that I really feel like at a time when everything in America seems to be black and white, and people are very binary, this is a story about somebody who was complicated. And you're the one who pointed out the Archie Bunker comparison. I think that's accurate. I mean, when he goes out to the umpire and he says, you're here for one reason, to F us. I mean, he's kind of standing up for the working man. He's a symbol of something, of working class Baltimore in that time.
That's what Archie would
So I
say
wouldn't
to
take
his
that away from
boss,
him.
right? Down at the plant, right? Like literally, Fred
Yeah, I
Flintstone.
wouldn't
It
take
was,
that away from
just
him.
all of
Yeah,
that, right? I mean, Ralph Cramden,
he was
he had that chutzpah, right?
he was coarse, and he was, he was, yeah, he didn't go to college. I mean, he was rough around the edges, and he stood for this kind of like, yeah, grievance, even like white grievance. I mean, I think he was part of the working class and stood up for that against, I say the blue bloods from New York and Boston. He was somebody who represented, complaining to your boss, complaining to the man, standing up to the man, symbolized by the umpires.
Well, John Miller has finally made the baby in real life as well as with the book, The Last Manager. Analytics, stats, all of
By the way,
go ahead.
Nestor, I have to say that my wife yesterday with a straight face, our son's name is Oscar, and with a straight face, she said, "Did you ever consider naming him Earl?"
Is his middle name Gamble or no? Madison.
No, but I know about Oscar Gamble, obviously. But yeah, Oscar is his name. Anyway, go ahead.
I love that's a great name. The big O, right? For a little
Yeah,
basketball
yeah.
season too. The analytics side, and I know you were fascinated by this, and I think it's one of the reasons. And I hope at some point in life I want to tackle any topic, the way you've gone after this the last couple of years, the way all of you professional authors, Eisenberg takes on a topic, and I don't see him for 3 years. He comes back with a book, on black quarterbacks or on Cal Ripken, and I, he, but with you with this thing, you took this on, and I think maybe the sale to the publisher and you to people is not just Earl World Series, Baltimore baseball, like all, race, all these other things. I think there's a point where the game changed so much, and he was so prescient in the way he viewed the game about On base percentage, math, all the things my dad loved about baseball was the math part of batting averages and ERAs, but he took it to a different math level that maybe some people not as smart as Jim Palmer couldn't understand at various points about pinch hitting and having note cards and the science of baseball, not what my eye tells me,
Yeah,
because that was the way baseball, hey, I got it up here. That's the way baseball scouting was. You know that. You're one of them.
Earl was very smart, and Harry Dalton hired him partly because he was so smart, and he understood the mechanics of baseball, and he understood essential analytical principles we have today, like on base average. He promoted an outfielder named Don Buford, who a lot of older fans will remember. And Earl made him the everyday leadoff hitter. He was not batting well, batting average wise, but he drew a lot of walks and he had a 400 on base average. So one of the first things Earl did was promote Don Buford to everyday play in the outfield. Again, African American player, over Kurt Bleffery, a white player. And Earl also understood the importance of pitcher batter matchups, that you could have a bad hitter like Mark Belanger, but who would hit people like Nolan Ryan extremely well. And you can match those weaker hitters up against the pitchers they could hit. And Earl was instructed by, in the minors, there was a future big leaguer named Juan Pizarro, who was won over 100 games in the major leagues. And he always owned these minor league teams Earl played on, but Earl could hit him. And Earl would think, everybody else is going to go 0 for 4, but I'm getting my knocks today. And he would get two or three hits off Juan Pizarro. So even as a player, Earl realized the physics of baseball are complicated. And sometimes, again, you can have a bad player who does well against a good pitcher. And if you understand those nuances, you can take advantage of them. He also innovated strategically in a way that people, don't even dare do anymore. Sometimes he would have a pinch hitter lead the game off on the road and bat first, and then put at shortstop, and then put Belanger in the bottom of the first. Earl's reasoning being that pinch hit is worth just as much in the first inning as in the ninth inning. Why not start the game with one of your best hitters? And then go from there, and you save a Belanger at bat, because Belanger was a terrible hitter, but the
I
best
remember
shortstop
when
in the
he did
world.
that, and I remember my father trying to
Oh,
explain it to me, and I remember the games he did
yeah.
it.
Roy, I think Roy Stillman was the guy's name. And they also they made it a rule that you had to bat the DH at least once, because Earl figured out on the road again, or anywhere actually, you could bat a pitcher on his off day at the DH spot, and then when that spot in the order came up in the first or second inning, you could just pick the hitter you wanted. And you wouldn't burn a hitter. You'd have basically a blank slate until the second or third inning when the spot came up. And so they
Is that
changed
like
the rule. They
when
made him work.
Belichick confused Harbaugh in the kickoff in the playoff game? Kind of sort of like that, a little bit.
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know,
I was told
confusing
not
even the
to bring. I was
umpires
told.
probably at that point, right?
I was told not to bring up football with you.
Oh, hey, you know, I mean, it's mixed season here. I mean, the season just ended. I'm glad it's baseball season, and I'm glad the book is finally out for you. As a child, and I don't know the answer to this. I mean, I grew up in the early 70s. You mentioned Roy Stillman, like all that. Tom Chopin, I'm down with all of that. You're not never going to get Don Buford or his son Damon Buford through me. But 73, 74, 75. I was a kid and a smart kid, and I always wanted to remember every number. And I knew all the coaches, right? Bamberger, Billy Hunter, Jim Fry. I never really knew who his real consigliere was. Who was Earl's best guy? Who through all of it, I never knew. I mean, Bamberger went off to Milwaukee, and Fry did his thing. Billy Hunter went to, but did Earl have a ride or die? Did he have a BFF, really?
It was Pat Sannera and the groundskeeper was his best friend. They were
Okay.
thick as thieves.
I knew that friendship, but I didn't know in baseball that that was, and how did you access information other than through the Palmers and the Singletons and the players? Were there any contemporaries of his at all who would have maybe some insights, not as more peer-to-peer than player to manager?
His Kim Benson, his stepdaughter, so the daughter of his second wife, Mariana, she talked to me quite a bit, as did all three of his children, who are all still living. And so that, like, the personal thing, like the Pat Sannerone friendship, came from them. I'm told Tom Maher, I think you probably knew, was also somebody who would make sure Earl got to bed, not on time, but got to his own bed in his own room on the road. I talked to a lot of people. I talked to probably 30 Orioles players, everybody from Dempsey to Cal Ripken to Palmer a little bit, media people, umpires who knew Earl. By the way, umpires, they would battle with him, but then after, when they were both retired, they would be at the same cocktail circuit telling these stories to fans who
Well,
were
there
very
was a
eager.
total off-season circuit in every American League city where there was a Frank Slifka who had a
But
Thompson Sports and would bring Willie Mays in. Yeah.
To be more, I mean, I actually should point this out. Like, the Earl Weaver, the person, I mean, this is a book about Earl Weaver, the baseball manager. So, for example, his drinking, I didn't pursue stories of him outside of baseball. His widow, Mariana, she's an old lady now. I didn't bother her. I mean, she talked to me once, and then I didn't like try to unveil the ins and outs of their marriage, for example. If Earl Weaver passed out in the clubhouse, I thought that was fair game to include in the book. If it was in the context of baseball, those stories are all in there. Tibby Martinez telling me on the plane one time, Earl was passed out drunk, and they put a cigarette in his mouth and lit it, and he choked on the smoke and woke up. So those stories are all in there. The stories about him, I mean, it's a little bit about his children and his marriage. I mean, like all baseball families, it was complicated because he was often, not home. He was on the road with his band of merry men. So it's not a judgment or indictment of him as a human. I mean, this is really about him, the baseball person, and the psychology you alluded to and all that stuff. It is in the context of baseball. And so most of the people I talked to were baseball people. I was very intrigued by his family upbringing, Uncle Bud. I talked about the bookie. His family gave me documents, pictures. We found police records about Uncle Bud being an illegal bookie. I talked to the son of Earl's high school baseball coach. She told me about how his dad coached high school baseball. As a baseball coach myself, that interested me a lot. So there's a lot of depth, yeah. And again, I think the answer is, I mean, Cal Jr. did tell me that Earl and Cal Sr. would go drinking on the road together, and they would get so drunk that Earl would fire Cal Sr. And the next day he would rehire him. But I don't know if those were what I would call like intimate friendship. I think Pat Sannarone, that was an intimate friendship.
Yeah, I just never sort of knew. And through all of this, his life hasn't been chronicled that way. I don't want to say he was forgotten when he left. He would come back and do a Papa wave and have a couple drinks and tell some old stories with Palmer and do that thing and would come back for the old timer Papa wave thing. And I guess that's why I felt so honored when you called me doing the book that I had sat down with him for the last time and you found it like to be compelling and that he talked to me about things that apparently he didn't talk to most people about. He was kind of a little taken aback. At one point, he got a little chippy with me about ask, like, why nobody asked me that kind of thing, kid, kind of stuff. But in the case of peeling back the onion and the interest in the book from a baseball Luke Jones who's young and was born in the 80s and thinks of Earl the way we think of Casey Stengel or somebody you can't touch or reach in some way. What is the baseball gift in all of this? The three-run homer and pitching and defense, all of that. What was Earl's big idea for the game as you see it?
I think that's a good question. I think it's a lot more complicated than people understand. Earl didn't give up bunting until 1977. That was the year the Orioles pivoted towards the big inning strategy. Probably because he had Mark Belanger, who was the worst hitter in baseball history, pretty much. And so he would have Belanger bunt all the time. But they bunted above league average many years. 73, when you got into the Orioles, they were a pitching and speed team. They had Rich Coggins, they had
Bunbury,
Bunbury, these guys
Coggins,
who could.
sure. Baylor, young
Who could
Baylor, sure.
steal bases, and so Earl, I mean, his genius was really he was very adaptive and flexible. When he got Eddie Murray, Lee May, Lowenstein, Reneke, then he pivoted towards three-run homers, and I tell the story in the book of how he came up with that phrase. But I would say, as a baseball coach, it's strike throwing, and it's understanding that you want to be over the plate all the time, and then you just can't throw the same pitch twice in a row. I mean, I used to coach when I coach kids, hit your spots, probably because of Earl. I don't do that anymore. I say, throw it down the middle. It's probably not going down the middle anyway, but just don't throw the same pitch twice in a row. Change speeds, put some spin on it. And so I think that, to me, understanding the mechanics of that is more valuable than the three-run homer thing. And I think Earl understood that you're going to fail sometimes. Sometimes you are going to give up home runs, but you still got to throw it over the plate. You got to win the battles over the plate. And understand the percentages, and the percentages part comes from his love of gambling. I mean, he understood that if you win 3 out of 5, you're still going to lose 2 out of 5, but the odds are in your favor.
John Miller has inked the quintessential book on the life, a little biography of the last manager. It's Earl Weaver, how Earl Weaver tricked, tormented, and reinvented baseball. It has gotten high praise. It is made available on March the 4th. He will be in Baltimore at Enoch Pratt Library on my father's birthday, March 5th. Pisces, just in time for March Madness and all of that other stuff that goes into it. I just want to say this on Weaver because I'm looking forward to fingering through this thing. I'm hoping to get down to Sarasota for some spring training, and we got an early baseball season. They open in Canada. Geddie Lee might be there, so I'm thinking, what would be wrong with Canada for a couple of weeks this time of year? I hear Canada's nice this time of year. Make some friends up there. I might need them. But I would say this for Earl, and my thoughts about Earl and baseball and all the years of my fandom is he would talk about pitching and three-run homers and that sort of thing. And this is before big money got involved, and we thought big money was involved in 77 and 78. We looked out and saw Don Baylor playing for the Angels and DeCinces and all that went on. But the pitching he had, and when I go back and I look at the bubblegum cards against history, because I lived through it all, whether 69, 70, 71 was a little early for me, but I feel like I was a part of that. I went to playoff games in 73 and 4, but 79 to 83, and the thing that elongated Earl's greatness here and kept that job so he could have the Papa wave off in 82 and then call the game in 83 with poor Joe out the belly, poor and Howard Cosell ribbing him in the seventh inning up at the vet. Crazy stuff that happened. But the pitching, man, like Flanagan, well, excuse me, Palmer, then Flanagan, Martinez, McGregor, just through that era, and then the early era of the four ugly orange jerseys we're going to see with Dobson and Cuellar and McNally. It's we talk about Glavine and Maddux and Smoltz and what Atlanta did. Earl had it on both ends with Palmer, and Palmer's the greatest Oriole ever, and I can't say that enough. But the pitching he had and what that represents, not just to make Earl smell good and win a lot in a time where there weren't wild cards and money and you'd have to pay pitchers $230 million to keep him around or worry about them pitching in Scottsdale. Had there been a Scottsdale in the 70s, Palmer would have been a Diamondback. But I would say this, he had great players, but man, he won and but pitching and pitching, and he knew what to do with it. He knew how to keep it healthy. He got it to the mound, man.
There's this line about Earl that was Dave McNally said first. The only thing that Earl knew about pitching was he couldn't hit it. I mean, it's ridiculous. The Orioles, they won, I think, six Cy Youngs with Earl. Only two were not with Earl. Trivia question for you and your listeners, Nestor. Can you
Let's
name the?
start that again. Let's start that again because you definitely cut out. You said they've won six Cy Youngs.
So I believe that's right. Palmer won three. And I think Steve Stone,
Flanagan?
McNally, and then
Flanagan, 79.
the sixth one. You're right, Flanagan. Yeah. So, and no Oriole has won the award since, and no Oriole won before. And then they've had 20 game winners. I think only two were without Earl. So, trivia question for you and your listeners: can you name the two Orioles Cy Young 20 game winners without Earl?
Messina never won 20,
Nope.
so I know that
No.
that's incorrect.
One's 84. There's your clue. 1984.
Oh, it's 84. So was Boddicker? Boddicker won 20? Okay.
Boddicker won 20 in 84. And then
Robin Roberts, maybe? No?
Steve Barber in
Steve Barber.
64.
Barber.
And
Okay, Barber.
that's it. Everything else is under Earl. Bill James says this is one of the great mysteries why Earl's pitchers never got hurt, but they didn't. I mean, he basically had a four-man rotation, all the guys through 250 innings. And they just ate up all these innings and starts, and they did really well. And I think it was again because of this philosophy of throw strikes relentlessly, change speeds, be over the plate, let your defense do the work. One of the stats I unearthed, Palmer's batting average on balls in play was 250 at a time when the league average was 280. So that's how many extra runs the Orioles defense saved. And a rival manager said it was like trying to throw a hamburger through a brick wall to get a ground ball through the infield defense of Brooks Robinson, Belanger, Davey Johnson, and Boog Powell.
Well, throw Aparicio in there at 66 too, but that predated Earl,
Also part
or
of the tradition.
give Bauer
Who's
all of, hey, I'm trying, man. It just all, I mean, let me just play. John Miller is here. The book is The Last Manager: How Earl Weaver Trick Tormented It and Reinvented Baseball. And he's been tricking and tormenting poor John Miller for the last 3.5 years, dude. Like, let's get through this. What's really important, that green weird Atlanta A you have on your hat and Larry Lucchini. I mean, the book's going to take care of itself. You got baseball season. You're managing kids, are you?
We start March 20th, Alderdice High School, the Dragons. I love baseball. I love being a part of it. It's my first time coaching an American high school team, so a great challenge for me.
All right. You got any No, you're not going to say they're going to be really good, or you got the right pitcher, or
We
you
have
got an ace.
two kids who have who are headed to colleges to pitch, but no, nobody who's getting drafted this year. But again, Larry Lucchino, as a graduate of Alderdice High School. As are Mac Miller and Wiz Khalifa.
Larry Lucchino has a very storied history with championship rings. You're aware of that, right? Well, he also has his name on the wall down at Johns Hopkins, where my wife's life got saved. He was also a cancer survivor before he passed. So, Larry Lucchino, great friend of mine, great friend of Baltimore, and from your hometown where you're coaching baseball now. And Larry's got a fistful of rings. Should have been in Baltimore, but that's another story altogether. We'll talk about Peter Angelos. That'll be your next book. I'll put you. Well, I already did that. You gave you good research on that. The book is on Earl Weaver. It has happy endings and championships and all of that stuff. The Last Manager is out. Even George Will digs it. You're going to be in Baltimore. What are you going to be doing at Enoch Pratt? Just same thing you're doing with me, answering questions from the people.
Yeah, talking about Earl. Also sharing, the vision or the story, especially for younger fans who know the myth and the YouTube videos, but don't know the human being. So, looking forward to sharing that.
I'm going to chase Eisenberg down too, because I know he has some Earl Weaver stories and bird tapes and all that. Hey, it's baseball season, right? Like, I was going to book you a couple weeks ago in January. I'm like, nah, I'll book you the
I
day
think it's
after the parade. There's the Eagles parade, but I thought it was going to be the Ravens parade. But it is baseball season, and it is nice to kick it off with you. And I'm glad you finally. What are you going to do now? I mean, all you've been doing is just book. Is your wife asking you that? What are you going to do now, parent?
I have a 5 week old, so stay alive is the answer.
All right. Well, you exhale, coach these kids up there in Pennsylvania, and we'll see how it goes. And I have to find some excuse to have you back on now that you've had the book out. So when
Let's do
Father's
it.
Day, or when the Orioles are making that playoff run and using a 3-run home run and a pitching, then I'll credit you and make sure we sell some books for you during the holiday. But I hope the book's a big success for you. I know how
Sounds good,
hard you worked
Nestor.
on
Thank
it,
you.
and it's a great topic. Earl Weaver is the topic. Our favorite manager. The Earl of Baltimore is the last manager. The book is available anywhere good books are sold. Come on down to Enoch Pratt Library. We don't burn books around here. We promote them. Some of us write them as well. I am Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore. It's baseball season. It's Baltimore Positive. Stay with us.